We're going to turn back to Matthew chapter 2 and verses 1 to 12. I shan't read that whole section, I'll just read the first couple of verses, but we'll be looking at that section, so have it open before you if you can. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Well, we're continuing our series in Matthew's Gospel that we've recently started, and I'm really excited that this morning we get to meet the Magi as Matthew introduces them to us in his story of Jesus, rather than what normally happens, which is that I rip them out of their context and give them their annual outing somewhere between the carol services and Christmas Day. And that's sort of what happens, isn't it? We think the wise men, Christmas, get the wise men out, and they almost appear to us, not out of Matthew's Gospel, but out of our Christmas cards, carrying not just their extravagant gifts, but also weighed down with the baggage that 2,000 years of church history has laden onto them. And we have to spend all our time unpicking that baggage, and then we finally find the wise men at the bottom of it all. But today, we're going to let the wise men come straight out of Matthew's Gospel, because that's what we're looking at. And they're going to carry only the significance that Matthew ascribes to them, because Matthew has included these people for a reason. When Adam and I start planning the Christmas program, you can imagine that a whole lot of negotiations start to take place. We sit down at Adam's table and I say, "I want John's prologue." And Adam says, "Okay, you can have John's prologue, but I'm having the Magnificat." And we begin to divide things. And it becomes especially heated when we get to the carols. I want Hark the Herald Angels Sing, but if I'm going to have Hark the Herald Angels Sing, then I have to give over O Come All Ye Faithful and Silent Night. But I don't think Matthew and Luke sat down one day at a Judean bistro to divide up the component parts of the Christmas story, do you? You picture Matthew and Luke playing rock, paper, scissors to see who gets the shepherds and who gets the magi. And Luke wins the shepherds, and so poor Matthew is left with the magi to fit in somewhere. No, Matthew has the magi here, the wise men, because Matthew wants the wise men. And he doesn't include the shepherds because he doesn't need the shepherds. He wants the wise men as the first people who come into the story after Jesus' birth. They fit perfectly into what he's doing. Now, the story that we've seen that Matthew is telling us is completely grounded in Old Testament scriptures. We saw how Matthew began in chapter 1, verse 1, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. That phrase, the book of the genealogy of, has been chosen by Matthew for a reason. It's a very important phrase in the Bible. It appears only twice before this. And it appears in the Greek version of the Old Testament in Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, and Genesis chapter 5, verse 1. The book of the story of something. We've already seen, I'll just tell you it once more because it's so important you grasp this. This is Moses' way of dividing up history. Genesis 1, 1 to 2, 3 is his prologue to the Bible. It's his big picture of what God is doing in creation and his plans for creation. In that prologue, Moses is telling you that God's desire is to build a house, a great cosmic house for him to live in with men and women that he's made in his image and likeness. And these men and women are to fill the house with a family. And they're to turn the whole house into an Edenic temple where God and man and creation can rest. And it's all very good. That's the prologue. Chapter 2 of Genesis, verse 4 is Moses' chapter 1. This is the book of the generations of the heavens and the earth. It's Moses' story of what happened next and how we got to where we are today. That chapter is a tragedy, told in three parts, of temptation and fall, of exile from the presence of God, and then murder and increasing violence as man fills the house not with glory, but rather with sin. But planted right in the heart of that tragedy is hope. The hope of a son who is going to be born to a woman who is going to put everything right. Then you get the same phrase in chapter 5, verse 1 of Genesis. That's Moses' chapter 2, the book of the genealogy of Adam. And it's a story that unashamedly keeps focusing in on one family through whom this blessing is going to come. A son who's going to bless all the other families of the earth. A king who will come and reign forever. And Matthew then starts his gospel by saying, we're at chapter 3 of history now. This is the story of the generations of Jesus Christ. He's the child promised to Abraham. He's the son that David longed for. But he's a new beginning. Adam showed us this last time. He's Emmanuel. He's God come to be with us with this great purpose, this focus to his mission that he will save his people from their sins. Now he's been born, and the first people who walk into Matthew's gospel after his birth are Gentile wise men from the East. So let's try to work out what Matthew's doing here. What's he trying to tell us? Let's think first of all about the significance they grasped. Verses 1 and 2. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the East came to Jerusalem saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. Now we tend to think, oh, a star. That's interesting. Tell us about the star. Well, we'll get onto that, I imagine, at some point. But the wise men thought, ooh, a son. That's important. Let's go and worship him. The star is merely the sign. The real star of history is the sun. But what a thing for them to have grasped. The king of the Jews wasn't exactly an A-list celebrity in the eyes of the first century world, was it? I know some people are professional royal watchers almost, aren't they? They just love a big royal event. Coronation of a king, funeral of a queen, marriage of a prince, then they're going to be there. The reporter always manages to pick them out in the crowd, doesn't he? Goes over to them and he says on TV, I've got Mary Lou and Jolene all the way from Chicago. And he starts to interview them. Mary Lou, why are you in London today? And she says, well, we heard the news and we got our husbands to drop us off at O'Hare. Got the last tickets across the pond, and we wouldn't miss this event for anything. We want to be there. We are royal watchers. I don't think that the wise men are part of that club, do you? Turning up at all of the royal births over the Roman Empire. I'm guessing they weren't there when Tigranes IV, king of Armenia, was born. Or Comoscicus, king of Dacia. Or Tinkomarus, king of southern Britain. They were all born around this time, but I don't think you'd have found the wise men in the crowd pitching up wanting to get another royal mug, and a Jerusalem fridge magnet to add to their collection of royal memorabilia. But a king of the Jews meant something to them. As I say, it's amazing that they could grasp the significance, because we followed that genealogy in chapter 1 a couple of weeks back. And we followed it from the heights of Solomon's reign, when a king of the Jews really packed a punch in the world, when he carried some significance and some weight right down through the obscurity to a working class family living in Nazareth. And yet these wise men got it. They knew that the most important figure of history had been born. They knew that he was worth leaving everything behind in order to find him and to worship him. They grasped the big thread of the Old Testament, the Abrahamic covenant, that one who was born into a Jewish family, the one who was born king of the Jews, was going to be a blessing to them, the Gentiles. They got God's big promise that there would be a king who would make things right and reign over an everlasting kingdom with love and grace. And they want to be part of that. But there's another lens to view this through. We thought, what was the significance of all of this to the Magi? But Matthew isn't telling the story for the benefit of the Magi, is he? Who's he telling the story for the benefit of? You. His readers. And what is the significance of the adoration of the Magi to Matthew's gospel and your reading of it? That's what I want you to think about this morning. This is why we're letting the text do the work and unfold this for us. Matthew's saying the Old Testament is being fulfilled. He's splashing across the opening pages of his gospel, the great Old Testament evangelistic vision of the nations coming home. This is Isaiah 60. Words that were spoken to a defeated, broken Jerusalem when the sons of David had led the country to the edge of exile and ruin and defeat, and they think there's no future, and Isaiah sent to them to say there is a future. And he says those wonderful words, "Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. For behold, darkness shall cover the earth, and thick darkness the peoples. But the Lord will arise upon you, and his glory will be seen upon you, and nations, the Gentiles, shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your rising. Lift up your eyes all around and see. They all gather together. They come to you. Your sons shall come from afar, and your daughters shall be carried on the hip. Then you shall see and be radiant. Your heart shall thrill and exult, because the abundance of the sea shall be turned to you. The wealth of the nations shall come to you. A multitude of camels shall cover you, the young camels of Midian and Ephah. All those from Sheba shall come. They shall bring gold and frankincense, and shall bring good news, the praises of the Lord. All the flocks of Kedar shall be gathered to you. The rams of Nebaioth shall minister to you. They shall come up with acceptance upon my altar, and I will beautify my beautiful house." Kedar and Nebaioth. Do you remember? A few weeks ago, Sunday evening, the sons of Ishmael. You remember what was happening? God had promised Abraham and Sarah that they were going to have a miracle child through whom blessing was going to come. But Abraham and Sarah don't think the child's ever going to turn up. So they decide that they'll help God out of his predicament and provide God with a child. And Abraham is given Hagar, his wife's servant, as an extra wife. And they produce a son for God, Ishmael. And they go to God and they say, here we are, God, we've done it for you. And God says, I didn't want that, thank you. That's works. I deal with grace. It's not about what you give to me. It's what I give to you. And I'm going to give a son to you and Sarah, Abraham. And the blessing will come through that son. And Ishmael, who becomes the heads of the nations, the Gentiles, his children were Nebaioth and Kedar and the others, he will be blessed through Abraham's promised son, Jesus. And Isaiah is seeing it there. He's seeing the nations coming to Jesus and God beautifying his beautiful house, filling up the world with his church, in other words, with a family gathered from all of the nations of the earth, from believing Gentiles and believing Jews here. And Matthew sees it beginning to happen as the Magi, Gentile pagans from the east, come in faith and worship at the feet of King Jesus. It isn't just Anna and Simeon who'd been waiting for his arrival. The world had been waiting. And Matthew's saying the Magi led the charge of faith as the nations came to fall before the king. And he'll be saying, what about you? Have you grasped the significance of all of this? Have you joined the exodus of the nations out of darkness to come to the light of God that shines in Jesus Christ the King? Have you got the significance? They did. Have you? Secondly, we've got the light by which they were led. And you're thinking, at last he's going to get to the star. Okay, well, let's get to the star. What do we know about the star? Well, next to nothing, to be honest. I've waded through the pages of the commentaries this week. I've read Johannes Kepler, the 19th century German astronomer. I've learned all about conjunctions between Saturn and Jupiter in 7 BC. I've read about Kepler's preference for the idea of a supernova, a bursting star shining brightly for a little while around this time. I know about Halley's Comet turning up now around 12 BC. But I'm still none the wiser as to exactly what the star was. And I can be pretty sure that the Old Testament prophecy that sees this happening had come from the lips of Balaam, that wise man from the east, Numbers 24, verse 17. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. But actually, this is what makes preaching the text the way we are this morning so exciting. We're just following Matthew's lead, okay? We're not dropping in randomly like we normally do at Christmas, where we've just got to get to the bottom of what the star is. We're following what Matthew is giving us this morning. And I rather think that Matthew is telling us something by not telling us something. Matthew is so committed to the Old Testament, isn't he? Yeah? And quoting the Old Testament, or picking up great Old Testament themes and then signing it off with his trademark that the scriptures might be fulfilled. I'm not sure how far Adam's going to go with chapter 2 next week, but if he goes to the end of the chapter, he'll have three that the scriptures might be fulfilled. The flight to Egypt, the massacre of the innocents, the return back to Galilee. This is what Matthew does. He wants to keep underlining the fact that the scriptures might be fulfilled. But he doesn't do it at this point. And Matthew knows a lot more about Numbers 24 and the oracle of Balaam than I do. Because the spirit who moved Balaam's lips was moving Matthew's pen. He could easily have said, right, here's the Old Testament text, star's going to rise out of Jacob. He could have explained what was happening in the celestial heavens, said it was a supernova, it was a little star that was dancing around, leading them all the way. Or it was Halley's Comet that turned up and, you know, just pointed with its tail neatly. You know, Matthew knows what's happened. The Spirit who led the wise men is inspiring Matthew as he's writing this gospel. And he could have explained all of that to us and then added his neat that the scriptures might be fulfilled. But he just doesn't do it, does he? Look at your text. So either Matthew has missed a trick here, or Matthew's making a point. Matthew's drawing a contrast. And look at the contrast. You've got Gentile magi who clearly haven't got the privilege of access to all of the Old Testament scriptures, who by the little light that they did have were led to make a decision to seek and find the King of the Jews. And then verse 4, you've got all the chief priests and all the scribes of the people. You've got the Old Testament in their hands. And when Herod asks them about the location of the birth of the Christ, they don't have to Google it. It's there on the tip of their tongues in an instant. They don't even have to open up the scroll. They know it off by heart. They can recite the promises and the prophecies of God at the drop of a hat. And yet, what did they do with all that light they had? Can you see the contrast that Matthew's making? You've got Gentiles fumbling their way toward Bethlehem, longing to find the light. They've got a star that can only take them so far. They need the scriptures as well. But they're passionate and they're persistent in their quest to meet the king. And you've got the religious elite of Jerusalem who just know it all and do absolutely nothing with the knowledge that they have. Well, will Matthew record Jesus' words later, Matthew chapter 12, where he says, the men of Nineveh will rise up at the judgment and condemn this generation because they repented when Jonah preached to them. And behold, something greater than Jonah is here. And Matthew's expecting you and me to reflect on all the light that we have and the response that we've made. You're saying, but I want a star. You don't need a star. The stars have done their bit. The signs have had their say. The shadows have been chased away. Lights dawned in the coming of a sun, and you and I have now got a book. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham. You don't have to feel your way in the darkness toward Bethlehem. You can open up the gospel and meet Jesus there. And that brings us thirdly to the response that they made. This is what Matthew's interested in. Not how much do you know, but what have you done with what you know? And we've got four responses here. A, we've got the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Verse 3. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. So here's the response of Jerusalem. It's alarm. Adam was telling us something about the character of Herod last Sunday morning, and I'm guessing he's going to have to tell us a lot more about Herod's character when we get to the end of chapter 2, but he told us that Herod murdered his favorite wife. I was sat down there thinking, oh, if he murdered his favorite wife, what did he do to his not-so-favorite wives? And he murdered some of his children, I think. This man was an absolute monster. And Jerusalem is worried that if Herod is having a bad day, then they're going to have a very bad day. They just want the status quo to remain. Herod is a tyrant. But life is tolerable under a tyrant so long as you give your unfailing loyalty to him. You never, ever pose a threat to him and you pay his exorbitant taxes. Just don't upset him or we'll all suffer. Is that much of a life? Here's Jesus coming as the shepherd king who's going to look after you. And they're not interested in that because they've got a tyrannical king that they have to look after. Make sure they don't tread on his toes, keep him happy all the time, and he might he might just let them live for another day. That's what Jerusalem accepts. Survival rather than life. There comes a point in the gospel where Jesus asks a man, do you want to be made well? Do you remember it? I always thought that's the most stupid question you could ever have asked anyone. Why did Jesus ask that? But it isn't stupid. Sometimes people just don't want to be made well. And Jerusalem just wants to be left alone. It's okay living in its prison of fear and darkness and subjection to Herod's whims. It's okay as long as it can survive for another day. Not interested in anything being put out of the ordinary. This is the same city who at the end of Jesus' life elects to choose a failed political saviour, Barabbas, rather than come to the king because they didn't want to upset the Romans. That's a common response to Jesus, who comes offering you life and hope and joy and everything new. And we're just like, no, just leave me be. Life's hard enough without any more changes. It was one of our prime ministers, Lord Salisbury, prime minister at the end of the 1800s, when the economy was tanking, everything was going wrong at home and abroad, heard that people were beginning to turn against him and they wanted change. And Lord Salisbury said, change? Why do they want change? Aren't things bad enough already for them? It's Jerusalem here. It's a very good motto for politicians, I think. It's bad enough already. Why do you want change? But then B, we've got the high priests and the scribes. And what's their response? It's apathy, isn't it? A couple of years ago, Toby Phelps, a 25-year-old professional ornithologist. That means he likes going out to photograph birds. Oh, is it a twitcher, do they call them? He managed to see two incredibly rare birds. They've been blown to our shores, to the coast of Pembrokeshire, by Hurricane Lee. One was a magnolia warbler, the other was a Canadian warbler. And Toby posted it online. And the very next day, thousands of bird watchers had descended on St. Govan's Head. Couldn't move for telephoto lenses poking out of trees and bushes. These birds had never been seen on our shores before. And so bird watchers had flocked to Wales because that's what they do. Now, what about the priests and the scribes? They are professional Christ watchers. They've been looking out for this baby for centuries. And yet when the news of his arrival is announced, they can't even be bothered to leave Jerusalem and make the short journey to Bethlehem to meet the greatest figure of all history. So we've got the alarm of Jerusalem. Please don't, just don't shake our world, just leave us be. You've got the apathy of the chief priests and the scribes. And then you've got the antagonism of Herod. Herod knows the significance of the wise men's question. You know that he asks the priests and the scribes, where is the Christ to be born? He knows that it is quite possible that the person they are looking for is the Messiah, the central figure of history. And behind all of his duplicity is his desire to fight against God and overthrow God's plans and destroy the one that God sends to save us. He sees Jesus as a threat and he wants him out of his world. Now, I'm assuming that you are not a tyrannical mass murderer like Herod. But Matthew's interested in your response too. Are you willing to come to him and into his kingdom? Or do you see him as a threat? Someone to fight against and to push out of your world. That's what Herod was doing. But then, D, we've got the Magi and their response, which was adoration. A star goes before them and illuminates what the scriptures had said as it leads them to a house in Bethlehem. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh. That's not what you're supposed to do when you meet a baby, is it? Fall down and worship him? That's what you do when you meet God. But these wise men were wise. And they knew that that baby was God. That he was Emmanuel, God with us, God come to save us. And they fell before him and they worshipped him, not his mother, him. And they gave him their gifts. We could go into all the significance of the gifts. It's what we tend to do when we just take the whole story out of Matthew's gospel and we talk about gold and kings and frankincense and God and myrrh and suffering and death. And maybe that was in Matthew's mind. It's all very neat. I'm not sure it was. I think probably in Matthew's mind is the next part of the story, that these expensive gifts helped fund their flight to Egypt and their stay in Egypt. Because in the very next verses, this son is going to come into great danger. Someone else has grasped the significance of this child, and he wants him dead. And that's Satan. He doesn't want you anywhere near this child. Certainly not bowing in worship and giving your life to him. He knows that he's dangerous to his kingdom, because he's come to save his people from their sins. The one who begins the gospel announced as the King of the Jews is the one who will end the gospel with that sign over his head. He's nailed to a cross, the King of the Jews. And it hasn't all gone wrong. It's actually all gone right. Because this is what the King of the Jews came to do. He came to save you from your sins. And he could only do that by going to a cross and taking all of your sins onto himself and paying for them in your place, so that you and I might be forgiven and swept up through faith into the family of Abraham and the family of God. Here's the Shepherd King who loves us and cares for us so much, that not only was he born into poverty, but he was prepared to die, abandoned, forsaken, under the curse of God, so that you might have life. Who wouldn't want to come to a king like this and to know him and be his? Perhaps you're thinking, I'd like that king to be mine. But I don't have enough gold to bring. And I don't know where I can buy frankincense. And I'm not even sure what myrrh is. Well, you don't need to know those things. It isn't about what you give to him. It's about what he gives to you. And he'll take you just as you are this morning. And as you receive him by faith, he'll give you the right to be a child of God. And he'll take you, he'll wash you, clothe you in Christ's righteousness, and he'll add you to that beautiful house. And you say, well, I'm going to spoil the house. No, God will keep working, and through you, he will beautify his beautiful house. What's your response? That's what Matthew's interested in. Well, what did the star look like? How do you respond to the sun? Is it with alarm? Is it with apathy? Is it with antagonism? Or today, will it be with adoration? Let's sing our last song, which is What Love, My God.